Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Matt and Ted Lee are brothers who grew up in Charleston and moved to New York in their 20s. They had what they thought was a great idea, to sell bold peanuts to all the Southern-themed joints in the Big Apple. It didn't go well.
We discovered they were mostly theme Southern bars and restaurants because they didn't know what boiled peanuts were.
There wasn't a Southerner in the house.
Wasn't a Southerner in the house, and they said, "What is this wet thing that you're giving me? I don't want to touch that. Take that back out."
But the boiled peanut fiasco helped launch them into new careers in the food world. They created a catalog of Southern foods for other folks who had moved away. They started writing about Southern food in articles, and that led them to cookbooks. And now they've written a different kind of food book. It's called Hot Box, and it's about catering, what they call the food world's riskiest business. This is the first time we've had two guests at the same time on Southbound, much less two brothers. So to help you tell them apart while you're listening, Ted is the one in the hat. Matt and Ted Lee, we were just talking just before we started on air. Matt, your birthday is coming up.
Got a significant birthday tomorrow.
I want to, and you have an interesting present.
Yeah, well, a present to myself, and it just worked out so perfectly for this trip to Charlotte that I could pick it up in a parking lot. Actually, I couldn't pick it up. What we did was the guy I bought it from and I slid it into the tailgate of my Acura SUV because it weighs 575 pounds. It's a sorghum mill, a cane mill. Sugar cane, sorghum, you put it in there and it squeezes the juice out. It sounds kind of simple, but these are iconic, you know, manifestations.
They're really
of
hard.
Southern.
He's been looking for one forever and they're usually kind of in the $4,000 range.
And this one was a little bit better.
This one was $800.
Oh, wow.
And it appears to have all its parts, no cracks, no fractures, and they're super easy to disassemble and scrub and polish and repaint. And so I'm going to restore
it. And so this fall you're going to be making sorghum, or how is that?
I hope so. I've got a couple plants, which is not enough to make sorghum, but I'm going to use the seed from that to do a big crop next year.
And are you just going to like put this in your backyard or something?
I don't know that I can put it anywhere. My wife wouldn't let it in the house or the garage. My short-term plan is to put it in our office in downtown Charleston.
Well, that makes sense. Sure.
Yeah. And then eventually I'm hoping to find a kind gentleman farmer, gentlewoman farmer, benefactor who can like situate it. Because you need to build a mounting plinth for it that's at the right height, and then you have to construct a pole, usually out of a piece of, you know, a branch to attach the mule.
I was gonna say, or the tractor. Do you need a mule for this?
Well, what I really want to do is do, some people use a lawnmower, and I want to do an electric lawnmower and have it be solar powered. That's my goal.
Oh my God.
The 21st century, 19th century yeah. sorghum mill. It's yeah. perfect.
Unless I can find a mule.
Yeah, well.
Inside the mind of my older brother.
So, but before we get to Hot Box, which ended up being one of those books that I think I didn't think would fascinate me, but it ended up fascinating me from the subject matter. I want to just make sure our listeners kind of understand y'all's background a little bit.
Sure.
You both grew up in Charleston, right?
Correct.
And I guess I want to start by asking, you know, there's been a Charleston now is considered this, you know, sort of world-class
sure.
food city. And I wonder how y'all felt about it growing up.
Well, it's so interesting that growing up, we really, you know, there weren't that many restaurants. Like,
it wasn't a restaurant town.
It wasn't a restaurant town. So that's all in the last 20 years, really, that in our lifetimes that's happened. And so there's part of us that absolutely embraces it. We love that there are great restaurants in Charleston. But there's also part of us that, when visitors come to town, you know, we try to say, but, you know, there's a home cooking tradition here that's amazing, too. And so we try to get them hooked on, you know, our cookbook or many of the other cookbooks from the early part of the century, from the 19th century that are about this place.
I do wonder about this. Was when y'all were growing up, was shrimp and grits a thing at all?
No, it
not
would
really.
It,
would,
it was breakfast shrimp.
Well, it's funny because I grew up on the coast of Georgia.
Yeah.
And my mom and dad worked in a seafood plant, and we fished a lot and that sort of thing. And for us, shrimp and grits is what you had if there was nothing left in the house. You know, it's like, oh, what do we got? Oh, there's a few shrimp.
Right.
Some, and to see that become this like $25 a plate thing was just hilarious to my family.
Yeah, it's like, how many truffles can we shave on this to push it into the $40 range?
Right, exactly.
You know, and you're like, no way.
Yeah. And so the origin story for you guys is sort of food writers and food people
came
when you moved up north, right?
It's well, it's much more complicated than that. I'll try to simplify it. But I should note that we're headed up June 1st, 1994. Florence Fabricant wrote about our boiled peanuts business in the New York Times. That was 25 years ago that we got into the food business almost by accident. It was really a performance art piece. We were upset that we couldn't get boiled peanuts in New York City, set out to make it possible. Very quickly found, thanks to Florence Fabricant, that there was this community of expatriate Southerners around the country willing to pay top dollar to, you know, FedEx those boiled peanuts. So we moved immediately back down to Charleston, set up the office that we still have today, and set up a little mail order catalog, shipping peanuts, but also stone ground grits and Duke's mayonnaise and all these food items that, you know, didn't travel well.
Syrup. Yeah.
Cane syrup and sorghum syrup.
And that
soon to be homemade.
I'm always going in the wrong direction, trying to make my own.
Yeah.
But in any case, we were smart enough then just to sell other people's sorghum and grits and things like that. And it grew into a writing career because of an editor at Travel and Leisure magazine in 1999 was a customer and assigned us a story on South Carolina. And that was our first clip, and we were off and running. And that led to the New York Times and developing recipes. And that led to creating a cookbook, our first cookbook in 2006. And now who knows what we do. We do book publishing, clearly.
I mean,
but
I think you're mostly known for being cookbook authors at this point.
Right.
But then Hot Box is a sort of pivot from that thing that we did for 12, 15 years.
Yeah, it's food writing, but not
but a
cookbook.
Sort.
Right. Although there are some recipes in there.
There's
like
one recipe.
Rotini for 600, right? Yeah.
Well, so, and the end goal is simply for it to be a good read.
Yeah.
And it happens to take place mostly in New York City, which is a big departure for us being mostly concerned with Southern subjects.
Yeah. So I want to back up just a little bit. In that moment in 1994 when y'all were just, you know, making boiled peanuts, or what before that happened, what were your plans? What were you going to be, you thought?
Yeah, sorry, I skipped over that. Ted was working in publishing, funnily enough, as a $14,000 a year editorial assistant and being bounced from company to company.
And working, you know, 100 hours a week, doing all my boss's editing.
Right.
And then his boss got fired. He inherited his boss's entire list.
Oh, wow.
Thing that'll be familiar to any author.
Inherit his salary or his title or even any promotion.
Just the work.
I was borrowing his suit to interview at Christie's and Sotheby's because I had studied art history in college and was very serious about it and had taken jobs in like the decorative arts and sculpture department at the Fogg Museum, and I'd worked for an antiques gallery, and so I was kind of headed in that direction.
Yeah. Now, I remember hearing stories, maybe I hope I've got this right, about the two of you going around to bars in New York trying to sell boiled peanuts as like bar snacks.
Right, that's because that was the idea.
We
thought we were going to sell boiled peanuts to, you know, wholesale to bars and restaurants, because there was, at the time, there were these Southern bars and restaurants that were cropping up. As we discovered, they were mostly theme Southern bars and restaurants because they didn't know what boiled peanuts were.
There wasn't a Southerner in the house.
Wasn't a Southerner in the house, and they said, "What is this wet thing that you're giving me? I don't want to touch that. Take that back out."
Right.
You know.
We did print up business cards that said Lee Brothers Boiled Peanuts, the snack of the 90s. And we thought that represented a long timeline. We were, you know, envisioning like, in 5 years, this is going to take the world by storm.
It seemed to make sense because what we did recognize about New York is that it's very open to all kinds of cultures and food ways. And, you know, you can get, you know, there at the time there was a terminal market in the Bronx that was known for you could get all the West African products. Fufu and, you know, and so we figured edamame, you know, the boiled soybeans that you have in the Japanese restaurants.
That's what we always called Japanese boiled peanuts. Right?
Japanese boiled peanuts, right? Exactly. So we thought that there wasn't much of an education to be You know, there wasn't much of a stretch. It wasn't a stretch, but...
But we was wrong.
We were wrong.
All right, so you did that. You went to the... Got the catalog out. You started writing cookbooks. And now you ended up at Hotbox. And I guess the first thing maybe to do is explain for our listeners what a Hotbox is. Everybody's seen one, but they may not know it by that term.
Have they even? I mean, the amazing thing about the Hotbox is it's so missable. It looks so innocuous. It's simply an aluminum sort of food service cabinet, upright, about 5.5 feet tall on casters, so you can roll it around the kitchen. And you open a door, a hinged door, and inside are just little rails to receive sheet pans. It was built just to move food around a large kitchen, like on a cruise ship or in a hotel. But what these genius early caterers figured out in New York City in the late 1960s, early 1970s, is they could hack this empty cabinet to serve as an all-purpose oven. If you put in a couple sheet pans with Sterno cans on them, all lit, let's say 12 on each sheet pan or 6, depending on your goal, you can, you know, create a commendable oven. The reason that was important in New York City is that they banned propane. Propane's not allowed in New York City. Everywhere else in Charleston, a caterer just backs up a truck with a couple propane-powered ovens on them, and you just ferry the food off. Everything's at ground level, and it just kind of doesn't matter. In New York City, you've got that verticality. Food needs to travel up 19th-century elevators, and you can't have open flames in the New York Public Library or the Metropolitan Museum or any of these kind of culturally rich venues for parties and galas that are so popular nowadays. But they weren't back before the 1960s. It wasn't even considered, it wasn't proper to do that. And then in the tough times in the 1980s, these cultural institutions and museums realized, oh my gosh, you know, this is a way to monetize our dusty real estate in a way that we haven't even contemplated.
And that start of catering back in the 60s, you know, it was really interesting to me that it seems like one of the big moments in the evolution of that business. It's kind of tied to North Carolina a little bit, right? There's a moment there where Fieldcrest Mills,
yes,
the textile mill,
yes, that's needs to have right.
I know you've written this book a while ago. I want to make sure. Yes. I'm aware of the moments.
Like, the North Carolina connection. Yeah, oh, there it is, Fieldcrest. Yeah, that's right. There was a very one of the early groundbreaking and sort of progressive caterers in New York was called Glorious Food. And that's how their business went from being a sort of like two guys working out of their apartment to being a real professionalized operation. Is that, and this happens to a lot of caterers where they're doing parties for 12 or 14, and then suddenly Fieldcrest Mills says, we're launching a new product and we need, you know, an oyster bar for 300 people. You know, that was an electrifying moment for this caterer, Glorious Food, that now still exists today.
This book starts with the two of you sort of observing this catering operation going on. And it wasn't clear to me, really, at the time that this happened, did y'all have a book in mind, or is this just something interesting you wanted to see?
It was kind of good luck, because we were like you. I don't think if anyone had said, like, oh, do you want to write even a story about catering? I don't think I would have. It was sort of beneath our regard, just by, I don't know why. But we had this lucky opportunity to observe an event where a restaurant chef was cooking offsite from Atlanta, was cooking in New York. And he knew that the kitchen he was cooking at, which was at the James Beard House, is small and difficult to work in. And so he'd brought in three friends who were caterers. And they just were so different. They just had such a different style of cooking than we'd ever seen, and they had a different aura than the restaurant chefs. You know, restaurant chefs, they've got their tattoos and they've got their statement frames and facial hair, and you know, chefs sort of carry themselves with an ego. And when these guys walked into the kitchen, it's important to remember, when they walked into that kitchen, they'd never worked with Steven before. They'd never been in that kitchen before. They didn't know what food they were going to prepare. They were sort of like culinary special ops, you know.
Dropping in by parachute,
like, what's the job? We'll get it done. And so, you know, we didn't know how it was going to go. And our friend Stephen Satterfield, the chef who was cooking that evening at the James Beard House, his food is very essential. It's very minimal. There's not a lot of like.
There's no gravy.
There's no gravy to cover for any technical fails. And these three men. This Patrick Phelan, who was the executive chef for a caterer named Sonier and Castle, and his two best deputies, Juan and Jorge Soto, who are brothers. And they just worked with a resourcefulness that we hadn't seen before. You know, when they ran out of griddle space, they just turned up all the burners on the stove and laid sheet pans down, and suddenly they had griddles. But you know, those kinds of moves are not ones that we're used to seeing in a restaurant kitchen or a home kitchen, certainly, which is home kitchens are our sort of frame of reference. But even in a restaurant kitchen, you know, you don't see that kind of ingenuity happening. And
so after this experience, we went out for beers with them, and we asked them further questions that brought out other, you know, mind-blowing insights. We asked about, you know, how they do those events for 800 people. Because, you know, to them, the 80 people they had done that night was trivial.
Yeah, that was the thing they said. We were like, oh, you guys did such an amazing job. You didn't even know what we were cooking. And they said, oh, that was 80 people. Like, we don't start sweating until it's 800.
Right.
But that was when we learned about the hot box and how the key to all this super fancy food in New York City is Sterno in a hot box.
So basically, in it sounds like in many situations, mm-hmm. Where caterers work, the food is sort of cooked twice in some sense, right?
Exactly.
Once back at the caterer's home
commissary
kitchen or
production kitchen.
And it's sort of given the beginnings.
Exactly.
And that will explain kind of how that works.
So you give it the color that you want back at the prep kitchen.
You mean by searing it or something like that?
Yes. And sometimes that includes, like, in the case of beef filet tenderloin, like throwing it in the deep fryer in a, like one of the basket fryers, 25 at a time, in these giant fryers, because speed, efficiency, that is the caterer's, you know, métier. And they know how to pull off these things logistically. I mean, they're logistics masters, and so they give it the color they want, but it's fundamentally rare, and then it moves to the site, and then, you know, 3, 4, or 5 hours later, the Soto brothers and sometimes the Lee brothers will, you know, pull those things out and put them in the hot boxes in such a way that you get 347 portions medium rare and 177 medium well, and just whatever's called for. They can manage that trick. What you have to understand, though, is they are processing these woven elements of time, energy, the way water and protein and cellulose react, in a device that has no dials. There's no readouts. There's no feedback except what you touch and what you hear and what you smell and your experience. It's just using your raw wits, and that's it.
That's what I was thinking. You know, if you're using an oven at home,
right?
You can tell what the temperature is, and you set a timer and for how long. And yeah. This has none of that, right?
And so, you know, if you can imagine, so they're working with, let's say, we're talking about beef tenderloin. That's the main course. They're working with you know, there's a time at which there's a run of show, and those are supposed to go out at 8:15, let's say. So they're working back from that serve out time to where they need to start warming it up. Because the other insane thing that caterers have to do with events is contingencies. Like, the host's toast goes on 10 minutes too long, and suddenly they're told, oh, serve out's pushed back 10 minutes. Well, they can't serve cold food.
And so it can't be more than medium rare. So what do you do?
So what do you do? You know, there are all these things that it became apparent nobody thinks about the caterers having to deal with that. They just
just go to these events, whether it's a wedding or a, you know, product launch or whatever, a gala, and we're just, you know, somewhat delighted if the food comes out more or less warm and isn't unsavory. But what you have to understand is, back behind the curtain, what they're up against is this insane expectation that everyone be served more or less simultaneously the same thing. Compared to restaurant, that's a much taller order.
When we come back, Matt and Ted Lee talk about why you might not want to peek into a catering kitchen, especially if you're a germaphobe. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Thanks to all of you for listening to this and every episode of Southbound. If you'd like to be a bigger part of our community, here are some ways to do that. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage. That's wfae.org/southbound. You can also email me with thoughts or questions at ttomlinson@wfae.org or just tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. It also really helps if you give Southbound a good rating and review on Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app. That helps us get out there to even more listeners. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Matt and Ted Lee. So the two of you talked a little bit about, you know, kind of minor things that you guys did during the course of this that were screw-ups but not disasters.
Yeah.
And I wonder if in the catering community, they tell stories about legendary
They're
disasters.
Legends. They're legendary.
Can, tell you a like, can we tell you a few? Yeah.
Sure.
So first of all, Scott Forzaglia is famous as an executive chef. He's a very accomplished executive chef who's been at it for at least a decade, probably more, who's worked at most of the major firms and has seen everything in his life. But he's famous among other caterers because he's a caterer who set the client's house on fire and didn't get fired himself. We don't know much more about it, except that kind of counts for a lot in catering.
There was sprinklers going off is a classic one. And there was one at the Tunnel nightclub about 12 years ago. And there that we know the chef who actually was there, and he has the sprinkler head still on his desk, sort of as a paperweight.
Yeah.
Right.
And there was another one at the New York Public Library. There are sort of these legendary... These stories get swapped around, and
there was one that's distinctive. I think Scott Forzaglia was also involved, where the catering team, on the brink of serving the entree at the culminating event of a 3-day bar mitzvah, I think, or a wedding on Long Island on that Sunday, about to serve out, the kitchen staff, executive chef, snapped off his apron and led a mutiny, and they just left. His entire team, leaving the struggling executive, like the service staff, to try to figure out how to produce the food. And it took them an hour and 45 minutes to serve out the main course.
The issue there was a safety one, and it was that there was some sort of flood going on, like plumbing issue, and the water had kept building and building up, and then suddenly it was like over their feet. So they were working in like
the conditions
4 inches
have been bad
water.
For a few days,
and then there were like electrical wires hanging everywhere. And he was like, "You know what? We're all going to die. Like we're not going to die for this."
Yeah, yeah. I wonder. This is not quite the same thing, but you know, I know people always think about when these kind of meals happen and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what's going on back there that I don't want to know about, and were there things that you two encountered that, as you were encountering them, sort of gave you pause, or that maybe somebody you ask people about later and they sort of explain, this is why this might be okay.
So, I mean, the other thing you need to know about catering is that oftentimes you're in the danger zone in terms of, you know, temperature, food safety. And I have no qualms eating at a catered event because I know it's a self-regulating system. If you make everyone sick at your event, you're never going to get another job in catering again. But that said, you know, to the food inspector or to, you know, the by-the-book person, it's going to look pretty renegade back there.
There's, you know, largely the kitchen is kept away from everyone's view because there's, I mean, for a variety of reasons, but I mean, the attention should really be focused on the celebrant. Right. The reason for the party is not in the kitchen.
There's no open kitchen catered event.
There's no open kitchen catered event, unless there's a tasting
and
station.
And the chef does not need acclaim or even thanks, really, at a catered event. It's kind of understood that you're going to be laboring in the shadows.
Right.
There are things like Matt once was trying to figure out with the other chefs, like, why the sauce
had
broken.
It's chapter 3, I think.
Chapter 3.
At the Frick Museum.
And he's like, they're all dipping their finger into the sauce and licking it. And, you know, that is the kind of thing that would just send a germaphobe around the bend.
Right.
So there's plenty of reasons to have that pipe and drape there. But what's interesting especially in the context of what we're hearing about sort of in the restaurant industry and, you know, having toxic kitchens and the Me Too movement has, you know, swept the... We found the catering kitchens, because there's so much teamwork in catering kitchens, and because pretty much everyone in the catering... in a catering kitchen, like, everyone's working on a team. We sort of have to do every job, and you just get put into your wherever the labor's needed, you're shuttled in there.
By design, it's a more democratic kitchen.
It's a more democratic kitchen in so many ways, but there's also so much scrutiny. I mean, remember, you have waiters, you have service captains, there's not really room for anyone to misbehave
or to, you know, to tarry. I mean, there's no time to towel snap or be rude to someone.
I mean,
you're kind of like you're behind the clock most of the time.
Yeah. But also, if you're there's no time. I mean, if I was idle for 10 seconds in a party kitchen, it would be like, you know, I soon learned, I ultimately learned how to follow like where the labor is needed. So I didn't have to be told where to go. But in the early days, it was sort of like, what are you doing? Your hands aren't busy. Get to work. You know, there's something to be done.
I know that through the book, the two of you evolved and kind of got to do more and more complicated work and that sort of thing. But I think, especially at the beginning, it struck me just how much work is involved in doing this. Could one of y'all describe, maybe especially when you were starting out, what a day might be like for you?
Sure. So we've got the there's a distinction to be made between the prep kitchen and that fiesta or party kitchen.
The prep people always want to be the fiesta people, right?
Not necessarily. Well. It's kind of self-selecting as well, just because prep is more regular work. You can almost count on 5 days a week, even in the dog days of January when there are no weddings. Fiesta is more seat of pants, more exciting, and $25 an hour versus $10 an hour. There's a lot of reasons to like it, but it's episodic. You might have three gigs stacked up on Thursday and Friday, or on Friday and Saturday, but nothing to do on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So it argues for certain types of people. People with families tend to do prep. Younger people tend to do prep because they want to be out partying on Friday and Saturday night. So it's really interesting to see how it breaks down. But anyhow, we did both, and we started at prep because we just had to. We had to learn the fundamentals and be trusted and earn a reputation in catering. And we could spend 4 hours doing the same task, mincing chives, filling 26 quart containers with minced chives. I mean, it horrifies me just to think about it. And I feel so grateful that I'm not staring down that challenge right this second.
Chives are tiny.
Chives are tiny. And your knife is not up to the task. You might have to sharpen your knife, you know, three times during that journey. And there are no knife sharpeners. In fact, you forgot to bring your knife. And so you're using that garbage one in the drawer. And, you know, woe is me. But if you spend 4 hours chopping carrots, your fingers turn orange. Why aren't we wearing food service gloves?
Even if you are, they turn orange.
Orange.
I mean, the other thing that was so frustrating to me is just not knowing where that labor was going, because we were just doing jobs for our production kitchen manager would say, okay, I need 3 quarts of chives, and then you do it. I need these carrots peeled. You do it.
So you might not even know what recipe
you have no idea.
You don't have the benefit of that satisfaction of knowing, oh, this is going to the...
Like, this is going to be the crudité at the...
At the Spice Girl, Vanessa's party at such and such a center. And so you kind of visualize the closure of these carrots in a way that we all experience when we cook for our loved ones and our families at home. That's a privilege, that satisfaction, that closure. And it's not until you become a cog in the catering wheel that you really gets baked in.
Did you ever or even often get to eat anything that you made or were a part of?
Well, sampling in the kitchen is discouraged, but a lot of the leftovers end up as family meals. So yes, you do get lot of sort of feedback. There's a feedback loop there.
And for a gala or a big party, a big wedding in the Hamptons on a weekend, like there will be a lot of people to feed at the end from the leftovers. Like there will sometimes be security staff. There will be, you know, all the service people, if there's a babysitting team. I mean, there were some really Baroque parties we worked. There was the sand sculpture team.
A lot of people who have worked in catering in the past and sometimes a long time ago have come out of the woodwork in the last months and weeks since the book came out, because they hadn't seen their experience reflected back at them. One of them, who's an actress, and a lot of them, of course, were in acting and theater, said, "Oh gosh, catering." And she distilled it to this. She said, "I just remember it as like stuffing my face full of veal at 1 a.m. while putting sleeves over stacks of chairs." The catering staff is often expected to help with the breakdown, getting rid of everything, and crating up the garbage and the rentals and all that stuff. But she just, you know, she remembers the leftovers as part of the package.
Yeah, like stuffing your face with veal while bagging chairs.
It's such a bizarre world. I remember probably the only fancy New York party I've ever been to was in somebody's apartment. And they had, I don't know, there were maybe 50 or 75 people there. Mm-hmm. And they took all the furniture out and put it on a truck. And my wife was talking to a couple of people and knew about this stuff. And she said, because there's no parking in New York, they just drove the truck around for 3 hours while they waited for the party to end.
You just pay a driver to drive it around.
That's insane, you know. And it sounds like y'all saw and experienced some of those kind of things.
Yeah, for sure.
It's kind of fascinating to watch how these events, because, you know, you can see them coming 9 months down, and then the days tick down, and you get closer, and then, boom, it happens. But all the support industries. We did a whole chapter in the book about the party rentals business, all the chairs and all the plates and cutlery and tablecloths and everything you can imagine is fascinating. But that service of emptying your apartment of chairs and just disappearing it for a certain number of hours, that is a separate business, you know.
Yeah.
And there are firms competing to provide you with that service. The staff, everything can be outsourced in New York City.
We talked about sort of disasters on your end, the kind of the culinary disasters. What about hosts or patrons or something? Are there stories also that go around about, you know, you don't want to deal with this person, or maybe anything that you encountered where somebody acted out or that sort of thing?
Oh, I mean, this is why the subject fascinated us, and why that first time when we met these caterers, we began to think, oh my gosh, this could be a book. When catering is ultimately a luxury product, right? So this is about, you know, rich people behaving badly on important nights in their lives on the one hand, and then food being tortured on the other in these weird ways. And you overlap those Venn diagrams and, you know, drama happens. I mean, there are clients who will try to, as we tell in, I guess it's the allergies chapter. We have a whole chapter about allergies and how that has destabilized catering, but not wrecked it at all. They have created some great strategies for dealing with that. But a family who created a whole menu, beautiful, lavish menu for their guests, and then created a whole separate one for them, for like the hosts and the family, mostly to contend with their food preferences. But their mandate was that the staff not make it look special. They didn't want the other guests to know.
I mean, it's one level of bad behavior to be like, actually, we're going to have all our own special separate meals
from our guests. Else gets.
Right? This is a party for 350 people.
But and let's presume that there were medical reasons for that.
Let's presume there are medical reasons. The directive was, you can't make it look like we're getting special meals. And it's like, wait, you have
do you want
eight waiters devoted to you. You have a whole kitchen staff creating, you know, chicken breasts where you're having hanger steak. I can't make the chicken breast look like hanger steak. I'm sorry. It's never going to happen.
On and on and on. I mean, it starts at the sales moment and where it's like an audition. Let's say it's, you know, your son's wedding. You know, you go around and do these tastings from firm to firm as everyone's trying to decide, you know, which one to go with and what's the better fit. But at those tastings, people will circle around the next day, usually in the company of an event planner. The event planner will make the call and say, we kind of like it. You know, we're close to making a decision, but can you just like knock $3 off per person off the entree? And it's like, that doesn't happen in a restaurant.
Right.
And there's all these ways in which the invisibility and the sort of shroud of like low expectations that surrounds catering conspires to make their job even harder.
So let's take it from the other end. Let's say that I'm, you know, decided I need to host a big party.
Yeah.
And hire some people to do it. Mm-hmm. What are questions that I should be asking the people who might be doing the catering?
You should ask like, what's your favorite party? Like, ask the chef, like, you know, tell me, like, what is, you know, because there is kind of a favorite party that every caterer has, you know, and it's usually, and it might be, you know, a wedding for 100, it might be a wedding for 300. But, you know, if you get a sense of what they think they do well, you'll get a better sense of whether it's going to be the right fit for you.
Ultimately, you know, you want them cooking from some kind of comfort zone.
You
probably don't want to be picking from menus A, B, C, D, and E, right? You want it to express, you know, what your hopes and dreams for your party and to be customized in some way. On the other hand, they can only do well what they do well.
Right.
You can't force them to do, you know, somersaults or present them with the dish, the recipe from your favorite restaurant and hope that something similar will come out of it.
But
at scale,
you know, we found that there's a lot of pressure from the sales force and the party planner, if there is one, to keep the host and the chef like
apart,
not having conversations with each other. And so our advice is usually if you are hosting a party, try to have a conversation with the chef. I mean, the salesperson's great, but the chef's is really the one who's going to give you the sense of confidence. I would also ask to see the kitchen. You know, when you're at the tasting, you're not far from the kitchen. And that's actually the, you know, those are the conditions. The conditions of the tasting are the best conditions that are ever going to, that chef is ever going to have.
Because
they're not going to be in a field.
Right.
They've got running water and gas.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you should, you know, when you go in the kitchen, it should be clean. It should be efficient.
It should be warm in the morning.
Yeah.
It's funny. It can break. You have to sort of choose, pick your poison. Like for me, I think a really good question to ask is bottled lemon juice or fresh squeezed? Because for a lot of volume catering, they go with that bottle. And I can taste that, you know, that preservative they put, the potassium or whatever in there. And you kind of have to decide for yourself, are you going to mandate that if they typically use bottled or not? You know, you'll find out everything you need to know with a few pointed questions.
But, you know, getting comfortable with what the caterer's comfortable doing and getting excited about what they're doing. If you're bored by what they're excited about, that's a bad fit. So, you know, some of the best parties we went to had some of the simplest food and food where you'd sort of be like, well, that's a cliche, but, you know,
comfort food
works. The kitchen knows what works because we see the plates come back. And, you know, fried chicken. Also, one of the best parties we did was a very lavish wedding in Greenwich, Connecticut, and it was comfort food. And it was just, everyone had a blast. They demolished it. Fried chicken, mac and cheese, bolognese, you know, for pasta lovers.
Carving station
for, you know, the roast beef lovers. And it was just like,
don't overthink it.
And everyone, you know, there was great music and everyone's dancing and just, you know, that's a successful party.
You talked about bottled lemon juice versus fresh squeezed. So are there shortcuts that caterers use that actually work, that maybe you wouldn't think some version of that, but it's actually okay?
So toward the end of the book, we describe just that situation where Patrick Phelan, our protagonist, the guy we met at the James Beard House and who we follow throughout his eventual departure from New York catering, he was doing his last event, and it was a giant cruise ship company. I think it was Carnival or
Royal Caribbean
was doing a sort of press event for 1,300 people. And it was his mentor in the business, Neil Gallagher, who was coming back, and sort of everything was coming together. Patrick had us for deviled eggs for 1,300 people peeling eggs one by one. And it was this epic thing. And we were doing it. And then the visiting chefs came to inspect the kitchen. And Patrick was, my guys are on point. Check it out. We're on this deviled eggs.
We had like three guys peeling eggs, just peeling eggs.
Right.
And the visiting chefs were one was Scottish, I think. And they were like, what? You're peeling eggs? They're like $60 a pail at you know, the food service place. Pre-peeled. Like, why would you do that? And like, I haven't knowingly tasted the pre-peeled ones, although I'm sure I have a feeling there's virtually no difference, that we'd have a hard time telling the difference. Certain tools, there's this fantastic funnel with a trigger that allows you to driplessly pour sauce on a series of plates. And it's called in catering in New York, a German funnel, but it's really, we found it online as a confectionery funnel. And it has sort of a spring-loaded thumb trigger, and it costs $60. It's not cheap, but man, that's handy. If you want to dollop that sauce instead of dribbling it over with a spoon, it's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're working at home, you only have 12 plates. It doesn't matter, but, you know, you might have 1,200, so you need
you
need the confectionery line.
But I did want to ask, are there things that, you know, you two learned, whether it's ingredients or tips or whatever, tools that now you use when you cook at home?
Confidence. I mean, we don't worry about time as much, I don't think. And partly because we do a lot more ahead of time. We're comfortable prepping 2 days out or at least 1 day out. You know, you want to have fun in the kitchen with your friends and spend time with your guests.
So. It's completely revolutionized the way I entertain, because I used to be always stressed out during my own party and never get to talk to the guests. And that doesn't happen anymore because I'm comfortable holding food. So I start prepping 3 days out. I have everything organized and in place. And then I'm also not as freaked out about, like, if the ribs have to sit for an hour, that's fine.
It's going to be okay.
I know the limits of, you know, the temperature zone. You know, they're more intuitive.
I know you said there are kind of two shifts, you know, the prep shift and the party shift, and they tend to draw different kinds of people. But did you find commonality at all in sort of the way people who did this sort of thing thought or lived their lives or kind of approached the world?
We experienced it firsthand, but we also asked people like Danny Meyer, who comes from restaurant world, but who set up now a successful catering company. It was a rocky road that we describe in the book, but it's that people in catering don't crave so much as restaurant people the comfort of a restaurant family. You know, in a restaurant, you have this anchor, which is the place, and you don't have that in catering. Furthermore, almost everyone in catering is a mercenary, with very few exceptions. And so they might drift away and come back 3 months later. And, you know, so you, if you're okay with that, if you don't need that sort of warm embrace of
nuclear
food service
family
then you're going to be cool with catering. And furthermore, especially for the Fiesta chefs, that level of improvisation and always craving a new territory and a new situation. In a restaurant world, you're mostly cooking the same menu night after night. I know it changes in most restaurants, or at least some restaurants, but for the most part, very familiar people, very familiar foods. In catering, it's kind of a new thing every night, and it seems to attract people who like that.
One last thing that I've noticed that at various points during this conversation, the two of you have been talked about it, a catering job. You said we. You know, you're still kind of in that tense with them. And I know it was a real grind, obviously, as you described, to do this. But now that you're away from it a little bit, what do you miss about it?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I miss the sense of fellowship. I mean, we did develop, as mercenary as it was, like, there are some familiar faces. Pamela Narain, who is the fixed full-time employee, the master of that prep kitchen at Sonier and Castle, is a wonderful human being and so great. And she led us through and kind of educated us about cooking in the prep kitchen. You know, it does feel like a family to some degree, and I miss that, and I miss midday family meal. Although what comes after, I'm happy not to see again. It's hard to go back to work after the family meal after a full morning shift.
I miss the teamwork of the Fiesta shift. Showing up to the party shift. You know, you show up to the party. It's maybe a different venue every. You know, it's a different venue most nights. So. And just that energy and electricity in the room, it's like, you know, it all has to happen. There's something adrenaline, you know, racing kind of, it's so fun. And it, you know, it's so different from night to night. So there are a lot of times I live mostly in Brooklyn now, and there are a lot of times I'm walking by like the service entrance of a venue that I've worked before, and I know they're loading in and I can see it, and I just like it's so hard for me to keep from like going in that door and like wanting to put on my suit, get out my knife, and get to work.
The energy.
You know, there is an energy that's really addictive.
I said at the beginning of this interview that I didn't think I'd be interested in a book about the catering business, but I knew I'd be interested in anything by Matt and Ted Lee. What they bring to the world more than anything is enthusiasm. They love to plunge into something, find out what they can, and tell us all about it. It's a refreshing attitude in a world that sometimes feels filled with people who are too cool to care. Enthusiasm is kind of like the hot box at the center of the Lee Brothers book. It doesn't seem like much by itself, but if there's a fire burning in there, well, it could do miracles. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web manager is Jessa O'Connor. Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you like to listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.